This is Cale Clark. Welcome back to the Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile apps. Part two of our new mini-series on Constantine. Constantine the Great. Now, if you missed part one, you're going to want to check the archives on the Relevant Radio app, relevantradio.com. Just look for the Faith Explained show or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, of course, we are there as well. And you can share them with a friend. Now, this is, again, in response to a question I got from a listener. There are so many misconceptions about Constantine. How sincere was his conversion to Christianity? But we do know this. God did intervene during his time. God did something pretty majestic, pretty incredible, which we're going to talk about in this episode, and helped to usher in an era of freedom for Catholics in the Roman Empire. And we're going to talk about that when we get there. But I just want to pick up where we left off last time. We're in the year 304 AD. Diocletian, who had been the emperor, who had unleashed the worst persecution that had ever been seen in the history of the Roman Empire against the Catholic Church, he was forced to abdicate by Galerius. Now, Galerius had kind of seized control through various political means, underhanded means. And it's a little bit complicated to list all of the people, all of the personalities that were involved at this time, but essentially the empire was very, very close to a state of civil war. There were all kinds of different leaders and people vying to be leaders, including Constantine. Now, Constantine was the son of Constantius Chlorus. Constantine was a hostage, if you will, in the royal court of Galerius, but he escaped and joined his dad. His dad soon passed away. And the troops of the Roman legions really, really liked Constantine, and they wanted to follow his leadership. And there was another guy that was involved too, Maxentius. Maxentius wound up taking control of Rome after Diocletian abdicated. And also, a lot of the soldiers really followed this guy as well. So they were kind of in the west, Constantine and Maxentius. And then in the east, there was Galerius, who was, again, hoping to control the whole pie of the Roman Empire. But he had his doubts that this was going to happen. In fact, Galerius tried to invade the territory of Rome, which was held by Maxentius, but his own soldiers, Galerius's own soldiers, wanted to go over and fight for Maxentius. So that wasn't a good thing. He had to retreat and go back to the east. So he calls Diocletian, who he had forced to abdicate, and said, "Hey, Emperor Emeritus Diocletian, any chance you'd want to get back into politics and kind of help me out here? Because I'm kind of losing control. My grand plan to control the empire isn't really working out as I'd hoped." And Diocletian said, "You know what? I'm kind of enjoying retirement now. You very much forced me into this. I didn't want to do it, but I'm just really digging my garden." No pun intended. He was actually growing cabbages, and he was just having so much fun with it. He had no designs on getting back into the political arena, the halls of power. But he does do Galerius a solid, and he says, "Okay, I'll come out and try to negotiate peace. I'll try to broker some sort of an agreement to try to keep the empire from destabilizing the civil war." Well, they didn't come up with the most elegant of solutions, but there was a new sort of junior emperor that was promoted named Licinius. He's going to play a huge factor later on. And sort of a shaky peace was established, but clearly things were not going well. Constantine at this time, what is he doing? Well, he is a really, really smart guy. He is an absolutely brilliant tactician, and he is hanging out in what is now known as France. Back then it was called Roman Gaul. He was in France, Gaul. He was also in Roman Britain, obviously now the United Kingdom, and he was just really strengthening his army. He was strengthening his forces. He was really assembling for a future battle that he knew was coming. Okay, so at this point, let's take a step back and try to figure out what is the state of the Catholic Church right now in the Roman Empire when it comes to this whole concept of being persecuted. Well, again, this was right after the absolutely brutal persecutions of Diocletian, who's now gardening and growing cabbage. But there was still a lot of persecution happening because of Galerius. And Galerius had sort of a right-hand man named Maximinus Daya. And Maximinus Daya wanted all the Catholics to die, if you will. He continued persecuting the believers. And he actually had a lot of them, he tortured many of them, put them in the stone quarries to work, essentially enslaved them. But while they were in enslavement, they would continue to organize themselves into groups and pray and continue to worship the one true and living God. That was not cool in the books of Galerius. And so we can't kill these guys, but we've got to kill them to get rid of them. That's essentially what they were thinking. So they decided to essentially expel many of them from Rome. Many others they just killed if they couldn't deport them. The list of martyrs kept growing longer and longer and longer. However, this is when divine providence began to intervene and give relief to the church. Galerius himself became very, very sick and near death. And in fact, he started to get really paranoid. Maybe he wasn't so paranoid after all. He had heard what Catholics had been saying about him, that God was going to punish him for all the persecutions that he was unleashing against the church. And he might have been thinking, this is exactly why I'm sick. It must be because I've attacked the wrong God here. And of course, being a Roman, he was essentially a polytheist. He believed in all the Roman pantheon of gods. And he started to think, maybe I should pump the brakes a little bit on persecuting the church. And so he decided, in an attempt to try to save his life, self-preservation, to stop the persecutions. On April the 30th, in the year AD 311, he wrote this document. I'm going to quote it for you here. Galerius wrote, "With all the laws which we have decreed for the good of the state, we have sought to restore the ancient rules and traditional discipline of the Romans. We have particularly sought to have Christians who had abandoned the faith of their ancestors return to the truth." What he's basically saying there is that he wants the Catholic Christians to stop worshiping Christ and go back to what he calls the truth, worship of the Roman so-called gods. He continues, "After the promulgation of our edict ordering all to return to the ancient customs, many obeyed for fear of danger, and we were forced to punish others." And what he's basically saying there is that some people essentially apostatized. They gave up their Catholic faith because they're afraid of being killed. Some refused to and were killed. This we know. He went on to say this, Galerius, "But there are still many who persist on their opinions, and we are aware that they neither worship nor serve the gods," that's the Roman gods, "nor even their own God," and that's, of course, the one true and living God. "Therefore, moved by our mercy to be benevolent towards all." Wow, what a great guy. He's saying, I'm so merciful. I'm such a merciful ruler. He says, quote, "It has seemed just to us to extend to them our pardon and allow them to be Christians once again, and once again gather in their assemblies as long as they do not interfere with public order. In another edict, we shall instruct our magistrates regarding this matter. In return for our tolerance, Christians will be required to pray to their God for us, for the public good, and for themselves, so that the state may enjoy prosperity and they may live in peace." End of quote. All right, so he's claiming to be this merciful, great guy. I'm going to let you worship your God after all. But by the way, you have to pray for the government, specifically me, because I'm really, really sick right now, and I think it might be because I was persecuting you guys, and your God is out to get me. And of course, this would have been the reasonable road to take, the reasonable tack to take in the beginning, just allow them to worship, allow freedom of worship. And of course, this is what we always have done in the Catholic Church, pray for rulers, pray for those in authority. We do this every time we go to Mass, and that is exactly what he's asking for here. And so with that, this ended most of the persecution that was going on in the Roman Empire against the church, although not all. And the more famous Edict of Milan, which involved, of course, Constantine, which we'll see in just a minute, that happened in AD 313. And most people see this as the moment that the persecutions of the Catholic Church stopped in the Roman Empire. But in reality, I guess you could call it the Edict of Galerius. Actually, it had, according to historian Justo Gonzalez and his incredible work is formed a great basis of my research on this. The Edict of Galerius, as I like to call it, was probably even more influential in stopping the persecution. However, when it came to his own fate, Galerius wasn't so blessed, if you will. He did die of his illness 5 days after he published this letter. There was a historian of the times, a Catholic historian named Lactantius. Okay, remember his name, Lactantius. He actually, when he wrote about this, he made it a point, according to Justo Gonzalez, that this shows that those who persecute the church would eventually die horrible deaths. You know, his repentance came too late, essentially. Well, at this point, what's going on in terms of leadership? Now that Galerius is dead, the Roman Empire is divided among four guys: Licinius, Maximinus Daya, who's still persecuting the church, he's the one kind of holdout, Constantine, and Maxentius. Okay, so what's going to happen next is going to be the great intervention, I think, of God in this whole situation. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. It's our mini-series on Constantine the Great, and we're going to continue on with it right now. Okay, so Constantine at this point is going to make his big move, and it came seemingly like a bolt out of the blue. No one was expecting him to attack anybody. But again, he's been biding his time. He's been building his army. And if there had been spies in his ranks, they would have realized this and got word back to everybody else. But it doesn't seem like anybody really knew what he was up to. All of a sudden, he brought his army together in Gaul, in modern-day France. He crossed the Alps, and he marched on the city of Rome. Maxentius has taken over Rome, and he is there. And at this point, Maxentius is absolutely shocked. He had no idea that Constantine was going to attack him, and he made really, really quick advances. Now, at this point, Maxentius, he sort of confers with his, I guess you could say, his joint chiefs of staff. And he says, what should I do? And the irony is, if he had retreated behind the city walls of Rome, Rome actually had great defenses. He might have been able to hold out against Constantine. History might have unfolded a lot differently. But his advisors said, you know what? I think your army is pretty darn good. I think you can take him mano a mano. I think your army should come out and fight this guy. Don't just let him come to the city gates. Go at him. And so Maxentius says, yeah, okay, all right, that sounds like a good plan. Let's do it. Well, it proved to be a fatal decision because Constantine's army overwhelmed that of Maxentius. And right before this happened, by the way, this is when Constantine had this incredible and famous revelation. And there were disputing accounts as to how this all came about. Remember I told you, remember the name Lactantius? He's one of the great Catholic historians of the times. He says that Constantine, on the eve of this great battle, had a dream. And in the dream, Constantine was told to place a Catholic symbol on the shields of his Roman legions. Now, what is that symbol? It's not the cross. It was actually the Chi Rho symbol. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you've certainly probably seen this. Chi and Rho are the first two Greek letters in the word in the name Christ. And it kind of looks like, in English letters, it kind of looks like a big X with a long, slender P, letter P, superimposed on it. This is the Chi Rho emblem, and it essentially is a symbol of Christ. And by the way, the Faith Explained logo was kind of based on that when I designed it. It doesn't look like a P and an X. It looks like an F and an X. I know, very, very clever. Also on a shield. But it kind of comes from this Chi Rho symbol. And you've probably seen this in churches. It's an ancient symbol of Christ. So did this come in a dream to Constantine? We're not quite sure, because the other major source on this is Eusebius, the great church historian. He wrote this famous book called Church History or Ecclesiastical History. And they, by the way, both of these guys, Lactantius and Eusebius, they both knew Constantine. Eusebius said that Constantine saw a vision in the sky. He actually looked up and saw this symbol in the sky, and he saw these words, "In this you shall conquer." And so he's like, okay, I'm going to do it. So he has this put on all the shields of the soldiers, and they're probably thinking, has this guy lost his mind? Has he become a Catholic? What is going on here? And this is the question. A lot of historians say, well, this is when Constantine actually embraced Christianity, became a Catholic, and said he started believing this stuff. Let's pump the brakes on that just a little bit, because we do know that even after this great battle, he continued to worship the sun god of the Romans, the unconquered sun. And the question of Constantine's conversion and how authentic it is, how sincere it is, we're going to take that up in future episodes of this miniseries, but we do know this. He had the symbol put on the shields. He had the symbols put on their military standards, these flags, these sort of, they're called the liberum, which preceded them into battle. And the soldiers were like, okay, well, let's go for it. And man, it worked. All I can say is it worked. His army thrashed Maxentius and his army. And Maxentius, I don't know why he was actually doing this, but he was actually involved in the battle personally. And he was toppled. It's called the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And Maxentius actually fell into the river and drowned to death. And so Constantine now has taken over Rome. Now, Licinius, who's one of the sort of rulers who's been installed in the empire, he meets in Milan with Constantine, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with Constantine's army. He knows how powerful he is, and he's like, look, let's forge an alliance. Let's make a truce. And so that's exactly what they do. They sign something called the Edict of Milan, and this is the famous document that says, okay, no more persecution against the church. We've got to return to the Catholic Church all of their public cemeteries where they buried their dead, they buried their martyrs, any buildings that they own, any properties that they own, let them have their books back. If we haven't burned them all, let's just let them live in peace and religious freedom. So again, according to Gonzalez, what Galerius wrote, the Edict of Galerius, I guess you could say, was more important actually back in 311. But everybody knows about the Edict of Milan, which took place after this incredible divine intervention. Was it a dream? Was it a vision in the sky that Constantine saw? It doesn't really matter. We do know something happened, and this gave Constantine a great victory. It leads to the legal, not only just the legalization of Catholicism in the Roman Empire, but it eventually becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. And this became a bit of a problem for the church moving forward, because how would the church react to not only newfound freedom, but this great status? Like, we are now the favored religion in the empire. We follow a crucified carpenter. Many of the early believers, of course, were ordinary men like Peter the fisherman, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, so many martyrs of the early church. The early church was such a motley crew, a mixed bag of slaves and freedmen, people of low status, people of high status. And now there are going to be many, many temptations of worldly power, temptations of comfort and ease and wealth. How would the church react to these things? Well, this is part of the problem that's going to happen over the next few centuries. And really, some might say, even into our own time, the aftershocks, the after effects of this incredible historical event are still being felt today. Well, we're going to continue on with our series on Constantine in the next episode. We're going to look at the sincerity or lack thereof of his own faith, and exactly how that developed. But it's a lot of fun to do history, and I hope that you're enjoying this. Okay, now we've got to dip into our Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. I want to give out the email address in case you want to send me a question. And also, if you've got an idea for the show, a new series that you'd like to see, why don't you email me? And the address is faith, F-A-I-T-H, at relevantradio.com. You can also find me on social media on the X app, the app formerly known as Twitter. My handle is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. So why don't we, without any further ado, jump into the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Let's go for it. Okay, today's question comes to me from Mary, who's listening in San Francisco, California, on 1260 AM Relevant Radio, KSFB. And Mary writes, "Hi, Cale, did you know that Mary had a PhD? I actually did not know this. Well, here's what she says. Our spiritual communion prayer implies that Mother Mary had a PhD. Let's break it down. P equals purity, H equals humility, and D equals devotion. I really, really like that. And she's referring to a very popular spiritual communion prayer. I wish my Lord to receive you with the purity, humility, and devotion with which your most holy mother received you, with the spirit and fervor of the saints." And that prayer was made very popular by St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei. More on that in just a second, but I really like this, Mary. I've never thought of this before, but it's a great memory device. PhD, purity, humility, and devotion. Mary says, "I like to have mnemonic devices when learning or teaching something new catechetically to my grandchildren. Yeah, Mary, that's a great one. I really, really like that. And let's get into the origins of that prayer, or at least how St. Jose Maria made that very, very popular. Well, St. Jose Maria made his first communion on April the 23rd, 1912. And there's a great piece on the stjosemaria.org website about this. In Spain, when he was 10 years old, when he made his first communion. At that time, children really had not been making their first communion at a young age. They would tend to make their first communion when they were about 12 or 13. But just 2 years before this, in 1910, Pope St. Pius X issued a decree, of course, lowering the age requirement for first communion. And he lowered it to about the time when children obtain the use of their reason. It's about the age of 7, give or take. It's obviously a little bit different for each child. But by the way, we're in a year when we're going to have a National Eucharistic Congress in the United States. During this year, in 1911, of course, when the Congress actually happened, there was an International Eucharistic Congress, which is kind of like the Olympics of the church because it's international. And that was going to be celebrated in Madrid, Spain, in June of 1911. So there was a huge effort of national catechesis going on in Spain and all the parishes so that as many children as possible who qualified could receive their first Holy Communion leading into that year of the Congress. Now, of course, St. Jose Maria, when he was a kid, his parents, Jose and Dolores, they used to teach him about the Eucharist. They taught catechism to him at home. And this is really the provenance of all Catholic parents. They need to do that. But he also had an instructor who was a priest, and his name was Father Manuel Laborda de la Virgen del Carmen. He used to be called, for short, Padre Manole. And before the first communion of St. Jose Maria, Father Manuel taught him this very famous prayer. Now, where Father Manuel picked it up from, I'm not sure. But this became quite famous because St. Jose Maria spread this prayer all over the world in the future. Father Manuel essentially told him, listen, Jose Maria, as you're preparing for your first communion, you need to keep this hunger for the Eucharist alive so you can make this spiritual communion prayer. And here's the prayer. I wish my Lord to receive you with the purity, humility, and devotion with which your most holy mother received you, with the spirit and fervor of the saints. And there's the PhD, purity, humility, and devotion. St. Jose Maria recited this prayer his entire life and taught it to millions of people, essentially, through his writings and through his example. Something else happened, though, as St. Jose Maria was preparing for his first communion in the year 1912. At the time, the style of the day, boys would have their hair curled in these, I guess you could say, for formal events, like a first communion, your picture is going to be taken. And it was very common for parents to take their kids to a hairdresser and for the boys to have these curls put in. Well, this is exactly what his mom did. St. Jose Maria's mother, Dolores, dropped him off at the barber shop. I don't know, maybe she went shopping or something like that. And the barber used a curling iron, which was incredibly hot, and he accidentally burned St. Jose Maria's scalp. And St. Jose Maria didn't say anything about this. He kind of offered up this suffering, and incredible for a child that young to do this. And he also did not tell anybody about this, not even his mom, because he didn't want the barber to get fired from his job. He didn't want him to get in trouble. So he simply offered the pain up to the Lord. Well, his mom eventually did see this incredible burn mark, this scar that was left. I guess she was combing his hair or washing his hair. And, oh my goodness, how did this happen? Well, eventually the truth came out. But this kind of showed the sacrificial spirit, even as a child, that St. Jose Maria had. And very often going forward in his life, he would view the pains and contradictions of life as kind of these caresses of Jesus, little splinters of the cross, if you will. Some years later, St. Jose Maria said that the first time that he received our Blessed Lord in the Eucharist, when he received his first Holy Communion, he prayed for his parents who had taught him, not only given him the gift of life, but taught him so much about the Eucharist, prayed for his sisters. And he also asked Jesus, please give me this gift that I may never lose you. I may never lose you. And he said, on this day of his first communion, he said, quote, our Lord chose to come and take possession of my heart, end of quote. So that's just a beautiful story of the first Communion of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei. And Father Rocky, of course, CEO of Relevant Radio, is also a priest of Opus Dei, and he tells the story an awful lot. And Father Rocky wrote an article recently about the spiritual communion prayer, and one of the things he said is that a spiritual communion is a personal devotional, and anybody can pray one at any time to express their desire to receive Jesus in Holy Communion. But maybe circumstances impede that from happening at the time. Could be anything. You could be, as Father says, maxed out. You've already received Holy Communion twice that day, which is the legal limit. You could be in prison. Maybe you can't attend Mass. You might be elderly and not able to get out of the home. You might be homebound, can't get to a parish. You might simply be listening to the Mass on Relevant Radio. Or maybe you're just in a place where there is no Catholic church that's near you. Well, this is what you can do. You can pray a spiritual communion prayer. You can pray this prayer that was popularized by St. Jose Maria, or another prayer. As Father Rocky says, there's no official spiritual communion prayer. You can make up your own. You could use a prayer composed by someone else. But when you do pray a spiritual communion, your soul does receive grace. And that grace will increase, as Father says, the more hungry you are for our Eucharistic Lord. And we certainly want to feed that hunger. We want to actually receive our Lord as frequently as possible in Holy Communion, daily if possible. We definitely want to spread this fervor to others, especially in this great Eucharistic year with the National Eucharistic Congress happening in Indianapolis, Indiana at Lucas Oil Stadium in July 2024. And if you want to go with Relevant Radio, we do have travel packages available, but they are going fast. So go to relevantradio.com and the Relevant Radio app and click Book Now to learn more. I'm Cale Clark for The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. If you have a question for me, you can certainly send it to me via email. The address is faith@relevantradio.com. You can also find me on the X app at Cale Clark. See you later today, 5 p.m. Central, live for The Cale Clark Show, only on Relevant Radio. And tomorrow, once again, for The Faith Explained.
From Brooke listening in San Francisco, my question is the part of the Apostles' Creed when it says he descended to hell. What does this mean? Why did he go to hell? In the Bible, you see a word in Hebrew and a word in Greek that refer to the same place. In Hebrew, it's Sheol. In Greek, we would say it in English as Hades. And it means the underworld. Jesus himself talks about in Luke 16, in the words of Abraham to the rich man, there's a great chasm that's fixed between where we are on the good people's side and where you are on the bad people's side. They were all in the underworld. And the good people were waiting for Jesus to rescue them because the gates of heaven had been closed by the fall of Adam and Eve. So when Jesus was dying, he says to the thief to the right of him, "This day you will be with me in paradise," where the just people of the Old Testament were waiting for Jesus, that he would go there and rescue them. That would be paradise, and then he would bring them all to heaven.
Have a question?
The Patrick Madrid Show.
8 a.m. Central.
On Relevant Radio.